Hey, I'm Linda Mariano and welcome to Science with Dr. Carl. This episode, we have a special guest, Professor Jason Sharples. He's a specialist mathematician and expert in bushfires. Coming up, you'll hear why fires burn faster uphill rather than down, what the most damaging area is to have a bushfire, and we chat general science too, like our first ice-obsessed caller. Let's do it. We have an interesting question that we're going to kick off in Wodonga with Dr. Melissa. What is your question? You're on Triple J.
Good morning, doctors. So my question is, I eat like two trays of ice every hour whilst home.
Ah.
And I want to know, I know I'm weird.
No, go on.
I want to know, eating ice do the same thing as drinking water?
From a physics point of view, what's the difference?
Well, it's just one's a solid, one's a liquid, I guess. I mean, and ultimately the ice will end up as a liquid in your stomach where it will hydrate you.
And you'll have to get energy from your body to warm it up. But eating ice can sometimes be a type of pica, P-I-C-A. Now, that's a clumsy word. And on one hand, it refers to some sort of typeface in printing. And on the other hand, it refers to eating dirt. And this is a tradition in many parts of the world where people will eat a bit of clay or dirt from a certain site to, if gravitated to it, their body knows, to fill the nutritional deficiencies in their diet. Now, in modern societies, we don't often hang around near cliffs where there's clay. And so the modern version of it is eating ice to kind of fill up a nutritional deficiency somewhere in your body. It could be just a habit that you've picked up for fun, because I do like the crunchiness of eating ice, but it almost might be a possible symptom of a nutritional deficiency. So see your GP and then get bounced to a nutritionist, dietitian.
What extra nutrition would ice give you as opposed to just having water?
It wouldn't give you anything, but you're desperate to eat something. Oh. So in a environment where you're closer to your environment, you'd end up sort of going to that cliff face over there and picking out the clay and chewing on it and sitting down and having a few bits of, just eating a bit of dirt. And this is surprisingly common in many of the so-called primitive societies where they round out their diet with what's missing by this sort of shared knowledge that's gone down the generations. But because we live in cities, you can't sort of go up to a brick wall and pull out your hammer and start chopping off a bit of concrete to eat. So you go for something crunchy, which is ice, and it's your body saying, in some cases, I've got a nutritional deficiency, I'm trying anything to fill it.
Is there any truth to the rumour that having ice is bad for you? You know how some people say, oh, don't have that, it's bad to be chewing on ice, it's bad for your teeth and it all. It doesn't get absorbed into your body as much as room temperature water.
It will get absorbed into your body. You just add heat. It can break your teeth if you get the ice at the wrong angle. So your teeth are pretty darn good. But if you live in, once again, these so-called primitive societies, you end up with your teeth being ground down by the abrasive diet over a longer period of time. But the other thing is you can also have cracks, because if you get the ice at exactly the right or wrong angle, which comes up against your teeth at the right or wrong angle, you can suddenly go chip. And you run your tooth across your tongue across your tooth, and suddenly there's a gap about half a millimetre or a millimetre across, which feels as big as a house, and you've chipped your tooth. So that's one of the disadvantages of chewing on ice.
Fascinating question. Dr. Melissa, someone's just texted in saying, I've heard that eating ice equals a lack of iron.
So, could be. See your dietitian, see your GP, then get bounced to a dietitian.
Fantastic. I just got a great one, Jason. I have to shout out to it, saying, Dr. Jason, you failed me on maths twice at uni, but you are still one of my favourite lecturers.
Ah, a voice from the past.
What can I say?
Can you pinpoint who that was? Or did you fail a lot of people?
No comment. Yeah.
No comment from Professor Jason this morning. And we were talking to Dr. Melissa before, who gave us a call about how she is constantly chewing on ice, having about two ice trays every hour while she's at home. We're getting a lot of texts saying, I craved ice when I had very low hemoglobin and severe anemia to the point where I needed emergency transfusions. We've gotten a bunch of texts about anemia and craving ice. Nellie from the Sunny Coast says the same thing. I crunched cup after cup of ice during all my three pregnancies. Doctors told me it was an iron deficiency and I stopped craving it immediately after giving birth.
Wow.
Interesting. We'll get into Jason's area of expertise right now with Dr. Sophie from Holbrook. What's your question?
Hi, everyone. I was just wondering, why do fires go faster up hills, like, rather than downhills?
That's a very good question, and actually we don't have a definitive answer for that.
Okay? What?
But
can I say that again?
We don't actually have a definitive answer for that. There's when you think about a fire, I mean, basically a fire spreads by heat propagating into unburnt fuel. There's two main ways a fire propagates heat. One's through radiation. So it's like when you stand next to a, you know, a nice warm fire, you can sort of put your hands out and feel nice and warm.
That's feeling the heat come through the air.
Through the air.
Yeah, yes. Radiating.
So
yep.
Radiation. The other one is convection. So that's when you sort of get a wind carrying the heat. So
gotcha.
Like, a,
yep.
like a hot breeze or something like that. So when you have a fire on a hill, I mean, if you think about a fire on flat ground, the flames will want to stand upright. When you're on a hill, even though the flames are standing upright, they're closer to the ground on the upwind or the uphill side of the flames. So you've got flames closer to the ground, which means you've increased the radiation into the unburnt fuel. And also as the wind sort of whips around, it can also increase the convective heat transfer into the fuels as well. So overall, you get an extra bit of heating above the fire.
Wow. I hadn't really thought of the fact that on the uphill side, the fuel, the grass, is actually closer than it is on the downhill side. Wow.
Yeah, which means it dries out quicker, the preheating is more efficient, and that gives you faster rates of spread.
Wow. Thank you for your call, Dr. Sophie. Another bushfire question from Tim from Adelaide. What is your one, Dr. Tim?
Hey, guys. I just wanted to know, why does a bushfire intensify when the smoke plume breaks through the inversion layer?
Wow. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah. It's, well, again, another interesting question, and one really at the forefront of the research. Very, very astute listeners today. The thinking is that when the bushfire plume breaks through the inversion, it's not so much breaking through the inversion, but the inversion breaking down. So what happens when the inversion breaks down is you have less inhibition for the plume to rise.
Can you explain, what is the smoke plume?
The smoke plume is basically when a fire burns, it produces hot gases, but it also produces smoke, which is little bits of carbon. And because the plume is hot, hot air is less dense, which means it's more buoyant, and so it rises. Mm. Okay, so as the plume rises, if you've got inversions in the atmosphere, they'll act as kind of a bit of a lid, and they'll prevent the plume rising. As the day warms up, you get heating of the ground that tends to break the inversion up. You get mixing down of more of stronger winds, which then can fan the fire to more intense levels.
Dr. Rob from Melbourne, what's your one?
Morning, doctors. I've got really cold feet, and no matter what I do, whether it's socks, UGG boots, put them in front of the heater, they're always cold, and I cannot heat them up. Is that a circulation thing, or is that something genetic, or what's going on there?
It is circulation. It is genetic. Your heart pumps about 5 litres of blood every minute, and it travels through the whole body, including in your skin, where you have got 100,000 kilometres of blood vessels. That's roughly 2.5 times around the circumference of the Earth, which is 40,000 kilometres. And during the day, different ones of these open and close. They're not just pipes. They're pipes with a bit of muscle around them, and they range from all of them shut when you're in really cold water or really cold air to all of them open when you're in a sauna. And on average, about 5% of them, 10% of them are open at any given time, and the ones that are open keep on shifting around. So this 5% is open, then that 5%, and it gradually shifts around. And all you need is just a slight shift this way or that, and you feel a little bit cold. A few different ways around it. You can run on the spot every now and then, and you get yourself feeling warm for maybe half an hour to an hour, and they call it HEAT, which is H-I-I-T, high-intensity interval training, you might end up a bit sweaty, but on the other hand, you do end up getting a bit of extra fitness, and that warmth will keep you going for a while. Just to have it documented, see your GP, who'll probably say, look, there's nothing serious. You're just one of those people who have cold hands and cold feet, but at least you know how to get around it, which is by being extra fit. And when you win the Olympics in whatever sport you choose, Linda and I will be very happy to drink a cup of tea with you.
Thank you, Dr. Rob. Kate from East Maitland, you've got a question about bubbles this morning.
Yeah, I do. Morning, doctors. Basically, when I blow bubbles from a bubble wand, in the same breath, they all seem to come out different colours. I'm just wondering why that is.
Can you describe what you've got? So is it like a soapy mixture and the wand is hollow?
Yeah, that's right. And when I blow the one breath, the bubbles come out and some have a purpley tinge, some are orange, some are green. Just curious as to why they're different colours.
Yeah, so, I mean, the colours you see when you blow bubbles, basically, it comes down to the thickness of the bubble. So if you think about, you've got this bubble, which is a round sphere-like thing, but the actual, you've got a shell, okay, which is kind of has a thickness to it. Light can bounce around in that shell, and depending on how thick it is, you'll have certain wavelengths of light either reinforced or cancelled out through a process called diffraction. And that will give you the colour. It's like when you have, if you spill petrol on water, you'll see it has a colour, and that's from this process called thin film diffraction.
And would it be related to the size of the bubble and then also then the thickness of the wall?
It's more the thickness of the membrane.
The membrane.
That forms the bubble, yes.
So it's varying thicknesses of the membrane.
Varying thicknesses will give you different colours.
And is that related to different sizes of bubbles?
It could be. I mean, not entirely sure about that.
Oh, I just suddenly thought of something because, Kate, when you're breathing it out, you're breathing it out with your lungs and you might be breathing at a high pressure or a lower pressure. And the trick to do is to get a little air pump and then get that, which is blowing to relatively constant pressure, and see if all the bubbles come out the same colour. And maybe you could get back to us next week or in the future when you've got some time.
I love that Kate is blowing bubbles.
Yeah.
It's so fun.
Doing
so
God's
fun.
Work.
Doing God's work, Dr. Kate. Another question about bushfires, that is Dr. Jason's specialty. Brad from Frankston, what do you need to know?
Good morning, doctors. I'm a very keen bonsai grower. And I'm very interested to know the effects of bushfires on trees. I'm interested in simulating bushfire on my little bonsai trees. So I guess the main question is for you guys is that between different trees, when you go through a bushfire area, some trees seem to cope very well and other trees seem to just, burn as you'd expect. Is there something that determines how a tree is going to cope with bushfire?
Yeah, so, I mean, it depends on the sort of tree, as you said. I mean, some trees in Australia are highly fire-adapted. They've basically evolved with fire, burning them at certain intervals of time, so they'll adapt and be able to grow back after a fire. But the main thing which is going to determine whether your tree survives or not, in a lot of the cases, is going to be how hot the fire is. So if you get a really hot fire which burns, the entire forest stand, the crown, the canopy, everything, then you're going to have a lot less chance of your tree surviving. If you get a low-intensity fire, like the sort of fires that we tend to try and put in when we're doing hazard reduction, these are fires which will just sort of creep through the undergrowth, take out all the leaves and stuff on the ground, won't tend to have flames which are very high and so won't bother the bigger trees. So that concept of fire intensity is really important, and as well as trying to understand how different species are adapted to fire.
And do we have in Western society any understanding of how the Indigenous people in Australia would try their different fires over this huge area that's Australia? Or it would be different, obviously, from place to place?
Yeah, I think, most of the people who are involved in cultural burning around Australia now sort of have this idea that, when you're doing cultural burning, you want fire to sort of move through the landscape like water. So you just sort of want it to trickle through the landscape, picking out the patches which are dry enough to burn. So this is really low-intensity fire, cool fire, okay? Hot fires are the ones which tend to kill things.
Because when Charles Darwin came to Australia, he described in Perth how he saw some Indigenous adults teaching the kids how to do this burning, and he was astonished at how little apparent effort they put into it, and yet over a day they did a huge amount of work. They just sort of put one here and one there and just sort of read the landscape, read the wind, and they did a huge amount of good with apparently little effort and great efficiency.
Yeah, I mean, fire in Indigenous society was a whole of society thing. So there were, you know, different people who were looking at different signals across the landscape, you know, the way different plants were flowering, you know, the way that fog was hanging over a mountain, things like that. And that gave them, I guess, cues to understand when was the right time to put fire into different pieces of country.
We're chatting to Dr. Carl and Professor Jason Sharples this morning on Triple J, chatting science. And Professor Jason is a acclaimed mathematician and bushfire expert. Chris from Tokenwall in New South Wales, what's your question?
Hi, guys. Just wondering, on the atomic scale, what is fire like? How would you describe it? Is it not like a solid liquid gas, or is it plasma maybe? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we're talking about ordinary bushfire type of fire, it's really little pieces of soot which are heated up and glowing. So when you see flames, what you're actually seeing is the hot glow of lots of tiny pieces of soot. As the soot cools, it will stop glowing, and that's where the flame stops.
Oh, so when I'm seeing a flame, say, half a metre high, that's a whole millions and billions of pieces of soot all incandescent,
yes,
and glowing. It'd be multiple billions, wouldn't it?
I haven't counted them, but it'd be something like that. Yes.
So in that case, would you think of flame kind of like love, in that love is not a solid or a liquid or a gas, but it's an event. And in the same way, flame is an event that happens when you get the oxidizer and the fuel and the ignition point, then you get this event happening?
Yes. I mean, the way a fuel or a piece of vegetation will burn is, I mean, the first thing you need to do is you have to have heat, you have to have oxygen available. You need enough heat to drive off the moisture that's in the fuel to begin with. And then after the moisture's driven off, the fuel will start to pyrolyze.
Okay, pyrolyze.
So these are all the sort of volatile gases being released. They're the things which actually burn. So they're burning in a gaseous state, but then they're producing these little particles which glow.
Hang on, are you telling me that you can't, that when something is burning, like I chuck a bit of wood on a fire, it's not the solid bit of the wood that's burning, it's the constituents of the wood that then come out as a liquid, so they go from solid to liquid and then into a gas, and it's the liquid turning into a gas that is burning. It's not the solid wood.
Yeah, so it's the pyrolyzed gases which mix with the oxygen.
Oh, because the oxygen is very thinly spread out in the air, whereas the carbon is very concentrated in a solid, so you've got to spread it out, so turn it into a liquid and then into a gas. Mm-hmm. So it's only it's only gases that burn, not solids or liquids. So if you're burning petrol, at the very top there's a bit of the petrol turning into gas.
That's right, yep.
Well, you learn something every day.
That's right, Dr. Carl. More on fire. Dr. Owen from New South Wales, what's your question?
Morning, doctors. I have a question. Why does fire draw moisture to the top of the soil once you burn off?
Can you describe what you mean? Like, can you just give us a mental image of the...
So, say we burn a wheat stubble paddock, the moisture, like, say, to come in and plough after it, the ground is extremely moist.
Oh, so how high would the wheat stubble be, like a centimetre or 10 centimetres or 100 centimetres?
10 to 200 200 mil.
Yeah, okay, so it's 10 to 20 centimetres. So there's this stubble, and then you set fire. And at this stage, so you've cropped the wheat, you've just got the stubble, and the soil is dry. Am I right so far?
Correct.
And then you set a fire through it, so the stubble is sort of feathery, and you get a fire going through, and then afterwards you're saying the soil is moist.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah, that's
interesting.
I could take a guess. When you're burning off, you're actually drying out the soil further, which leaves the top layer of your soil a lot drier. You always have soil moisture in the soil down deeper, and so if you've got very dry soil on top, that produces a gradient in the moisture, and moisture will then tend to flow with that gradient towards the surface. I'm kind of guessing there, but
and maybe
perhaps
there's
something like that.
And it could be an up current of wind that could be providing a bit of negative pressure that could help suck the water up?
Possibly,
wow.
Possibly.
This sounds like a really deep research question. And by the way, notice what's happened here, Dr. Owen, is that you've got some scientists who are saying We don't really know. And that's the nature of science, that you, when you make a mistake or you don't know, you just say, I don't know, and you work on it until you get an answer. I'm sure there's a paper on it. Somebody, if somebody's got an answer, can you go to my Twitter feed, which is at Dr. Carl, DOCTORKARL, why burning wheat stubble or any other stubble makes the ground significantly moister after the burning. Wow, Owen, you rock, man.
Thank you, Dr. Owen. Jackie from Redfern, you've got a science question.
Yes, doctors. Thank you for taking my call. My children and I were wondering why we don't sneeze when we are asleep.
Well, firstly, sneezing is incredibly important. With you got sort of this big pipe going in through your mouth, and then it one of them ends up at your bottom at the other end, and food comes in and goes out. So it doesn't matter if nasty stuff comes in, it'll come out the other end. You might get a bit of food poisoning, but it'll come out at the other end. But with your lungs, once it goes in, there's no other end. It stays there forever. So you have a very powerful sneeze reflex, which in some people is too powerful and can be set off by sunlight or spicy meals or a full tummy or thinking about sex. And you can sneeze when you're asleep, but it's really uncommon. And it's just the fact that it does happen, but rarely, while you're asleep, is an example of how powerful it is. It would probably only happen, this reflex, when you're breathing in dirty air and your body's saying, hey, look, Jackie, we don't want you to have stuff in your lungs. I'm going to make you sneeze even though you're asleep, and you wake up going, oh, my God, I just sneezed. What happened? So it does happen, but it's rare.
Ah, Dr. Taz from Kiama has a question about cooking for you this morning. Dr. Taz, what's your science question?
So my question is, if kinetic energy can be converted to thermal energy, is it possible to cook a chicken, like a raw chicken, just by slapping it? And if so, how hard would I need to slap the chicken?
I'm guessing of the order of not just 10 times of slapping them together, but I'm heading into the millions and maybe tens of millions of slaps. I'm sorry. And I think you'd find that along that pathway, the structural integrity of the chicken would have kind of vanished. It'd be heading into a mush. But there is a definite increase in temperature. Our machines can measure it. We've got temperature machines. We've got machines today that can measure that. But to actually cook it, you're getting above 70 degrees centigrade to kill a bacteria. Is that sort of your gut feeling there, Professor Jason? That's
a lot of slapping, yeah.
You're thinking, but it wouldn't be 10 or 100. It'd be up in at least tens of thousands or millions.
Yeah, and then there'd be the issue of actually trying to get that heat inside to cook the meat inside as well.
That's right, and some of the bacteria might spray off anyway. It is theoretically possible. If someone could do the mathematics or give us a link on at Dr. Carl.
I'm sure there's a YouTube video somewhere. Yeah. Taz from Kiama, thanks for your call. Nicola from Sydney with one. Talk to us, Nicola.
Hey, guys. I was just wondering, you were talking about how bushfires can be hotter and cooler and you can use them to control what you're doing. I was just wondering, how do you control the temperature of the fires?
It's not so much controlling the temperature, but it's more controlling how intense they are. Okay, so intensity of a fire is related to how fast it burns, its rate of spread, and that is controlled by things like how dry the fuels are and how strong the winds are. So if you want your fire to burn more cool, you do it on a day with lower winds, and you do it on days where your fuel moisture content is not so wet that the fuels won't burn, but not so dry that they're going to burn intensely. And so this is what fire managers do when they're looking at putting in hazard reduction burns. They're taking a very careful look at the weather, looking at the way the day is going to evolve in terms of the weather forecast, making sure the winds aren't going to be too strong, making sure that the fuel moisture content, which is sort of given to you by the temperature and the relative humidity, making sure that's in the right little window where you get your fire behaving the way you want it to.
Dr. Caden from Geelong, you have a question this morning. What is it?
Yeah, good day, doctors. I was just wondering, I work on power poles, and it's well known that if a power pole's been struck by lightning, it doesn't burn as well as one that has been. So I was just wondering why that would be the case.
I've had this question asked a lot of times. And so about 10 or 15 years ago, I actually did an experiment where I asked people on Triple J and other stations to send me two lumps of wood. One from a fire that had been, from a tree that had been struck by lightning and had burned a bit, and another one from an identical tree of a similar age that had not been struck by lightning or burnt. And we measured the hardness Now, the way you measure hardness is fairly straightforward. You get a little ball, maybe 2 or 3 millimetres across, and then you bang it with a certain bang. And if it penetrates deeply, the wood is soft. If it doesn't penetrate much, the wood is hard. You know, it's just a sort of a known way of measuring hardness. And we found that very consistently, yes, the wood that had been struck by lightning and or burnt was much harder than wood from a similar tree of a similar age in a similar environment. And then we had to go into hypothesis. The hypothesis is that in the act of being struck by lightning or burnt, that some of the volatiles are removed, evacuated out, and this is the bit where we're doing lots of arm waving, something happens to the molecular structure, we don't know what it is. But I then talked about this on the radio, and I got contacted by State Emergency Services people, SES people, around the country. And they told me that whenever they're called in, say, a domestic environment, lightning's hit, a tree has fallen on our house, can you fix it? They go out there, wait for it, with a bunch of chainsaws. Normally, a tree falls over, you go out with one chainsaw. But if lightning has been involved, you go out with a bunch of chainsaws because you cut part of the way through the tree and bingo, the chainsaw's blunt. And then you can sharpen it up, but it takes a couple of hours. So then you pull out chainsaw number 2, number 3, number 4. And so we've got this ground truth from the SES people that in their working knowledge that the trees are harder. And then, of course, later when they're back at the base, they slowly, painfully sharpen up each chainsaw when they've got lots of time. So we're pretty confident that they get harder and they get hard to burn, but we're not fully understanding the mechanisms of what happened to make it go down that pathway.
Wow. Wow, what a question. Dr. Caden, let's squeeze in one more, and it's not a fire-related one. Darcy from Bribery Island, what's your question?
Oh, how you going, doctors? My question is, how did accents start for countries that English is their first language? How come they have such strong accents like England, America and that? How did it originate? Did someone just start talking different one day, or?
Well, I've got no idea. So what I'll do is I'll ask my handy mathematician.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think it has to do with isolation. And I mean, if you actually travel around England, you can travel, you know, 10 miles up the road and people are almost speaking a different language. So what I would guess is happening is that, you know, you have people sort of isolated in their little groups. They all develop their own idiosyncrasies around the way they speak. Because they're isolated, those little changes or little idiosyncrasies will be reinforced. And then when you move to a different place or a different group of people, the differences are stark.
Wow. Dr. Darcy, what a way to end. It's Science with Dr. Carl and special guest Professor Jason Sharples. If you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to rate, review and subscribe. And as always, thank you so much for listening. I'll catch you next time.